Hello, I'm Paola, and welcome to Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM about what it means to live a contemplative, spiritual, and Christian life while still playing an active role in our modern world. Join us for conversations with fellow contemplatives in action from around the globe. In this episode, we'll hear from Kim Nataraja, a much-loved and respected teacher in the WCCM community. Kim will draw on the wisdom of her book, Dancing with Your Shadow. This is part of a contemplative path through the crisis program. We hope you enjoyed this talk.
So welcome, Kim from London. I'm in Bonvaux, you're in London, but we are together on the journey, and you will be sharing your wisdom and your experience of many years on the journey and the teaching with us today. And I think you'll be speaking about how two different worldviews, but pointing to the journey of meditation can help us to start the journey and to continue to grow on it. So
indeed,
please guide us.
Well, welcome everyone, and thank you for being brave to survive two talks and to listen to my third one. It needs courage, especially the one that's coming. Are you warned? So I already mentioned the nothing but neuroscientist, who conclude that everything we experience, especially in meditation, is nothing but a byproduct of the brain. I find that a hard one to take. So here I need to use the skills I have learned as a spiritual counselor. The main task of a counselor is to listen attentively to the other person so that our conversation becomes a meaningful one. And then slowly I'm able to work out how they arrived at that point of view. Now, none of my close friends or counselees are nothing but neuroscientists, so I can't check their reasons for their conclusions. So the following is only my assumption. And to share that with you, and that's why I warned you at the beginning, I need to take you through for a short walk, and it is a short walk, along the countryside of the history of science. It's only a short walk, so please don't switch off yet. So why is there this reluctance among that group of neuroscientists and lots of other people, because we respect scientists and accept their views, that why are they so reluctant to accept that there are other fields of consciousness we can tune into? They accept lots of fields. They accept electromagnetic fields, gravitational fields. They even accept that the gravitational field of the moon influences the tides in our ocean. And what about Wi-Fi? If we can use our phone or laptop wherever, and we are surrounded by fields. Anyway, so why is that? Well, it's my friend ego again, isn't it? It's a fear coming from the ego, our survival instinct, fear of the unknown, where the ego feels it's not in control. It doesn't know how to behave. Now, we are told at school what the world is like, and that knowledge made us feel very secure. We liked the worldview of Descartes and Newton, who stated already in the 17th century that there were mathematical rules laid down by God that governed all of creation and had predictable, never-changing outcomes. Boy, that gives security. Wonderful. But the second point of Descartes is, well, let me just share it with you. Descartes saw nature as divided into the realm of the mind. He called it res cognitans. Everything was done in Latin in those days. And the realm of matter, res extensa. Now, the trouble with that division is that it created a dualistic split between spirit and matter, between body, mind, soul, spirit, between humankind and the rest of creation. According to him and Newton, the human mind is totally separate. Our mind is separate from our body, from the rest of humanity and creation. In fact, in his view, we're isolated observers of the visible universe. That's all. We're just observers. And the only thing we could be sure of was our capacity to think. That was our real proof of existence. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. Now that is worrying. That causes total isolation. There is only the level of your own rationality you can deal with. No other levels of consciousness to tune into. And would you let go of your thoughts? Would you like it if someone comes to teach you meditation and said, now the main thing we're going to do is still our mind and clear it of thought? The immediate panic comes up and says, do I still exist when I don't think? Who would go there? Well, there is rescue. Then came in the early 20th century, quantum physics. But remember, for three centuries, that was our worldview. A worldview, excuse me. A worldview based on security, but also on isolation. Along came the quantum physics, names associated with them are Heisenberg, Pauli, and Bohr, and you know, you've heard of them. Now, they looked at the subatomic world, not at the physical world. And whereas the rules of Descartes applied to the visible world, they did not apply to the subatomic world. Well, it's easy to understand that that is quite a leap to take. We were confused. These were God-given laws. And they're just saying they don't apply in the subatomic field. It required a total shift in thinking. Moreover, there was the uncertainty principle. The way situations in quantum field would evolve could not be predicted with certainty in every circumstance. They were only potentials, possibilities. And then comes the good point. Depending on we, and note we, our human consciousness, designed the experiments, resulted in different outcomes. In fact, Heisenberg said, we have to remember that what we observe is not reality, nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. Wow, that makes us really and truly intricately involved. But the certainty and security has gone. We are left with uncertainty. And even Einstein had difficulty with that. And he stated quite clearly when he was chatting with Niels Bohr, God does not play dice. But a beauty, of course, is that we are no longer unobserved, uninvolved observers, separate from others, from nature, the cosmos, and most of all, from God, from the divine reality. Now we, I'm sure, having explained this to you on our little walk, it's difficult. And it's not only difficult to you and me, but it's difficult to understand by many, a very quiet, a quite clever and intelligent scientists. They were struggling, and they thought the way to deal with it is to go sideways and look at the applications. And the applications they're surrounded by laser systems, transistors, now quantum computers, and even, this will make you laugh, the humble toaster is an application from quantum theory. So from isolated observers whose only proof of existence was that they could think, we became totally involved, totally part of the whole. And therefore, meditation with the right brain, as I explained, allowed us to actually tune in. It's quite something, isn't it? No wonder it is a shift, a total shift in thinking. Now, the other shift that happened was since the 17th century, existence of spiritual and intuitive faculties were really ignored. Even the existence of God was considered unscientific, not by Descartes and Newton, but slowly as the centuries progressed, God was considered unscientific, couldn't be proven in the laboratory, and therefore was a primitive leftover of our past. Remember Richard Dawkins' books? Still influential? And then this and the way of thinking which we use in meditation, intuition from our true center, could also not be proven in a laboratory. So it was irrelevant. So much so that Albert Einstein felt called to stress the really valuable factor is intuition. And the cosmic religious experience is the strongest and noblest driving force behind scientific research. That is a confirmation, isn't it? The result of the difficulty of the quantum theory was that we remained in a reductionist, mechanistic viewpoint. Emphasis on ego and survival. We've talked about that. Qualities related to isolated individuals jostling for survival are highly praised. Power, control, aggressive assertiveness, determination, striving for status, achievement, material gain. Yeah, that's what dominates our world still, and perhaps has contributed to our present crisis. So let's go to this dramatic shift in perspective, which allows us to become aware of other fields of energy and consciousness, of our spiritual dimension, of our being beyond the ego. That is why now meditation more and more is coming to the fore. The slow percolation of the worldview of the being intimately involved, part of the whole, is percolating through our consciousness. There are different levels of reality. And not only that, all these different levels of reality are actually derived from and connected with an underlying reality, which hasn't really got a name. Science, one of the name is the zero point field. Doesn't mean much to me. But we've all, in all the religions, have tried to name that field that supports everything that happens. So is it a void? No, empty of form, yes, but full of potential. It's also both Christians and Buddhists agree. We are all interlinked through that field and exchange information. To quote a Christian saying, we move and have our being in this sea of energy. So we are all connected. In fact, David Bohm, a scientist, says deep down, the consciousness of mankind is one. Nothing is in itself. All, the human mind, the body, the spirit, we're all part of this infinite ocean of energy. This divine ocean of loving energy. Where there are patterns within patterns, relationships within relationships. And the result of this is that now, instead of being meaningless and isolated, we too have deep significance and meaning. We're intimately involved and co-responsible for the whole cosmos. Our behavior affects the rest, the famous butterfly effect. Well, that's the end of our walk through science. But if you think the idea of fields is weird, well, Meister Eckhart in the 14th century said, the soul is a field. Now, whether the fields they describe is the same, we do not know. As the Buddhists say, they are fingers pointing at the moon, not the moon itself. We use different mediums of approach. But yet, do they describe the same reality? I leave that question open. Also, at the same time that this quantum theory came up, spiritual and mystical experience again came to the fore. Evelyn Underhill wrote important books on mysticism. Carl Gustav Jung and the American psychologist William James drew attention to different levels of consciousness. Absolutely essential. In variety of religious experience, James said, our normal waking consciousness is but one special type of consciousness, while all about it parted from it, from the flimsiest of screens, their life potential forms of consciousness entirely different. When we acknowledge the existence of these different levels of consciousness, then we feel empowered to take up meditation, as it opens the door from the transformation of a narrow consciousness from a narrow confining one to a wider inclusive consciousness. And the regular practice of meditation, and I stress regular, allows us to experience really a totally different way of being, the way of being quantum theory has talked about, and a way of tuning in to this field, this ultimate reality. And then we discover, when we are in our own deep center, in the totality of our being, we realize, as John Maine somewhere said, that our center is the center of all being. And the beauty is, this is not theory, this is experience. We know intuitively that we are much more than isolating, jostling individuals, but we are constituent parts of the whole. And this view change allows meditation and is proven by meditation, by our experience during meditation. We move from the surface, where Newton and Descartes were, to the depth, where our knowledge, our knowing, is informed by the heart rather than the mind. With our mind, we may be focused on the outer world and turn away from our true self. But meditation leads us back to the inner world, the heart, the true self, the Christ within, with its intuition, wisdom, love, compassion. We experience that the divine reality, this field, is love. And we know we are an important aspect of the whole. And our every action, desire, and thought has an effect on everything, as I mentioned. We know intuitively, and that's something we need at this particular time. We know intuitively that we are personally co-responsible for the health of our communities, for the health of creation, and even the whole cosmos. And that's why I said at the beginning of my talks, contemplatives will save the world. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Kim, for speaking. Very, very heartening and encouraging. I think it's especially for many people today, many of whom are really feeling isolated and, you know, in the field of their own narrow world, or sometimes the walls of their world are closing in on them. Yeah. And if they think of the outside world during this time of confinement, it's often with a feeling of anxiety. Will the jobs be there afterwards? And will the way of connecting with people be changed forever, and so on? So I think the contemplative vision that you're reminding us of here, through the tradition and through science, through mystical tradition and material discoveries, is very encouraging. And I just have one question to ask you, and of course we invite people who are listening to this to send comments and questions. But The question that occurred to me was, is this. You speak about the discovery. What starts us on the journey of meditation is an intuition or a sense that we are more than what we think, for example.
Yeah.
And that there is this higher, deeper, more ultimate field of consciousness that you were describing. And first of all, as we meditate and as we become more familiar with this field of consciousness, let's call it our spiritual dimension or this energy of the sea of love that you describe, as we become more familiar with that, how does it change the other day-to-day, mundane fields of consciousness that we still have to inhabit and function in? We still have to do the laundry. We still have to make sure we've got a job.
Don't remind me.
there's enough food on the table. And we still have human relationships with the joys and pains and so on. So in this, how does the discovery and the familiarization that takes place through meditation with this larger field of inclusive consciousness, how does that affect our day-to-day development? Is it through a changing sense of self that you were describing, or how would you explain that?
Yes, I think you got it in one. It is a changing view of self. And the point is that if you change your view of self, your attitude that comes out of that is different. When you relate with other people, you relate from that point of compassion, understanding. You know what they're feeling. And instead of saying, oh, stop whinging and whining, so you're stuck at home, who cares? You realize, you empathize immediately. It is the ego that criticizes, not this deeper self. So I think it affects the way you behave. It affects the way you act. And whenever you do or say something, it comes from this point of truth within you, and therefore is valuable, even in any service you may do, as long as it comes from this deeper self rather than from a need you have to be respected, to be loved. And I'm sorry, I'm talking a little bit about next week. It's not the same. So it does change completely doesn't change who you are. You become who you really are meant to be. I think that's the way to put it.
Thank you. That's beautifully put. And finally, one other reflection. Many people come to meditation because they want to deal with the symptoms of anxiety or fear or restlessness or, you know, doubt, the sort of negative states of mind that can really cause us a lot of suffering and make us feel disconnected. So many people come to meditation with this very pragmatic approach. I want to get rid of these negative aspects of my mind and my emotions, and I want to be able to enjoy life and so on. And that's how many people in a secular society will think of meditation firsthand. But the way you're describing it is from a deeper wisdom tradition. And you speak about this field of consciousness that we discover through meditation as this energy of love. That's a very different perspective. And how many people would say, oh, well, that sounds good. Don't know what that really means. All I want to do is stop feeling so anxious or have panic attacks. And maybe there's a sea of love out there. But how do you think that understanding, which the wisdom traditions give us, that this inclusive field of consciousness in which all the other fields, as you describe, are sourced and contained. Is that understanding of love relevant to the meditator when they begin?
Oh, absolutely. I don't mind how people start meditation, because it is absolutely valid. Yeah, if when you start to deal with your anxieties, you just deal with your stress, brilliant. And it works. It works. We know that. It absolutely works. And that is a wonderful way to start and to get into a kind of place where so often you have had the same with people. They say, yeah, this is all good, but I can feel a longing. There is more. Yeah. And then they start looking for a deeper dimension. So they don't have to, but if they do, wonderful. Because we are all part of this field. And as I said last week, it's remembering. It's remembering.
Sorry? Oh, yeah. Okay.
This is being isolated. Yes, the world still intrudes.
This is an overlapping of fields of consciousness. I think we'll leave that in. Thank you, Shankar, for that great teaching.
Absolutely. So the whole point is, I think you said somewhere, we relax to meditate, not meditate to relax. But starting with meditation to relax is often a way in, and a very good way in. And then all we need to, there's this little voice within us. There is more. Come on, show me more. Yes. And it happens.
And there's always more.
There is always more.
Fortunately, we will have more of you in the next talk. So we'll give you a time to replenish and gather your thoughts for the next session. But thank you, Kim, very much. These are really, really helpful, enlightening, and supportive teachings. So thank you very much. See you next
thank
time.
You. Thank you. And next time, the shadow will start appearing.
Oh, okay. thanks for the warning.
Exactly. Goodbye for now.
Bye for now. Thank you.
Hi everyone, you're listening to A Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM. Just a quick reminder, if you like this show, be sure to subscribe. And if you want to learn more about the important work of the WCCM, you can find us online at wccm.org. And now, back to our show.
And I think today you're going to introduce the shadow. Tell us how the shadow moves into the picture. Life is composed of light and shadow. And tell us something about the games that the ego plays. So?
Yes, it's quite an exciting episode. The hint of the shadow. Anyway, allow me to recap briefly what we've been looking at so far, before we explore how our ego tries to hinder us on the spiritual path. Remember, between birth and 2 years, we were still part of an all-embracing reality, made up out of different fields, but all upheld and supported by a vast underlying field, the ground of all being. We were totally at one with it, aware of it intuitively, with what later mystics would call the interior senses. Then from 2 till 5, we gradually became aware we were in a different reality. And we changed and adapted with the help of a new facet of our being. We now call that the ego, who knew how to make sure we would survive in this reality. Some of us retain memories of that other reality. We were trailing clouds of glory. But for others, that memory faded soon in the background. And that, of course, depended very much on our personal circumstances, whether they be safe and loving or intrusive and even threatening. Now, the ego, this new part of our being, we discovered, started building a field of thoughts around our original being. For our own protection, we thought, using the thoughts of others, not our own, but we soon made those our own. That thought field was a mirror of the world we lived in. So we would be accepted, loved, secured, and even perhaps esteemed in the eyes of the others. Well, it did its job well. It helped us to survive, but it also isolated us from others. And moreover, we became more occupied with this new reality we found ourselves in, and we couldn't see beyond it anymore. In fact, you could call us prisoners. We forgot our original being and the reality we had dwelt in. And yet, at times, when faced with beauty in all its various forms, the veils in our mind hiding this original reality would part. And we would suddenly see that not only was it within us, but it still surrounded us. We were still one with it. As W.B. Yeats said, something drops from eyes long blind. He completes his partial mind. For an instant stands at ease, laughs aloud, his heart at peace. And this peace and this joy is what we feel when we see, not with our eyes, but with interior senses, the field, the ground of our being, the formless, out of which all forms spring into being. In other words, the kingdom of God. We have all heard in scripture, the kingdom of God is within you. And yet, have we accepted that? Or do we forget that? Well, that's a question. Now, these experiences evoked a longing. We felt, as it were, that it was calling us to return to our home. But how could we respond to this call? Well, we started the search. And often, a way home appeared. And for many, this was meditation in one form or another. And that's why meditation in our community is prayer. As you said, Lawrence, the simplifying practice of silence and stillness, beyond thoughts and imagination, the stilling of the activity of the mind makes meditation into prayer. And that's also why our mantra is a prayer word, as it is in many traditions. And meditation holds the key, as we have heard, the one-pointed attention to part the veils between these different realities. But that's the rub. It disturbs the ego part of our being. It feels it might threaten our survival and security and immediately start exceeding its job description and puts hurdles in our way. But you might think that I'm painting the ego as a baddie, but no way. We must not forget that it is, apart from its important protective survival element, which we need, the ego is another positive force. It is a force of energy, our rational, logical mind that tries to make sense of all we experience and learn, and we would be lost without it. We need it, but all we have to do is widen its field of experience. Meditation, as we've seen, enhances our power of attention that allows us to switch from our rational mind to the intuitive spiritual mind, changing our mind, in fact, from one way of being into another. And it does this by stilling the rational mind filled with thoughts. And that is not what our ego likes. When seeing the discipline we are about to embark on, it feels threatened and puts hurdles in our way, as I said. The first one is a good one. He or she asks, why change? You're fine as you are. And really, after all this time, you can't really change anymore. We smile and say, well, even you are not in a permanent state, our ego. You're in a state of flux. You keep changing and adapting. You are never the same. And we smile and let that be, because we have also learned in the meantime on our search that the connections in our brain are very flexible. There have been experiments that prove, and I find this amazing, that when two people speak to one another, the brain of one can have a direct and lasting effect on the brain of the other. It's an article I read in Scientific American of Eric Kandel. So I'm warning you, Lawrence, we both are influencing each other's brain. Does it work across virtual reality? I'm not sure, but it does. And that's why parents are always very, very worried if the friends of their children are not the ones they like. Well, the ego is really like overprotected parents. They mean well. They don't want to have their children leave their field of influence. They've, after all, kept them safe all these years. But life is not all about survival, is it? We need to accept that life is about change, and that we need to grow and evolve to be really and truly alive. And going in the silence is initially like leaving home. I admit that. But we need to do that to arrive at our true home. So we smiled at the ego, didn't make it feel bad, but we sat down to meditate nevertheless. Now, what does the ego do next? You all know that. You sit down to meditate, and what you are told is you will have stillness and silence. Oh boy, no you don't. You don't. The ego increases our awareness of thoughts. And seeing your mind filled with all these thoughts is quite embarrassing as we realize how superficial most of our thoughts are. John Maine called these thoughts the chaotic din of a mind ravaged by so much exposure to trivia and distraction. And Lawrence, you yourself quoted this story of Ramakrishna, who compared the mind to a tree full of chattering monkeys. Again, not very complimentary of us jumping from branch to branch. The monkey mind level of distraction. Okay, he tried, but the discipline teaches us to gently watch our thoughts. Let them pass by without attaching any significance even to them. They're just thoughts. You know, here an image comes to mind, which takes me back to my youth, which is always good. I remember hearing years ago about an advertisement for meditation. And on a poster, there stood an Indian guru in typical attire and appearance, and he was on his surfboard, balanced perfectly, riding the waves. And underneath the poster was the phrase, "You can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf." Well, we cannot suppress or get rid of our thoughts. They will be part of ourselves. And we've just got to learn to surf them skillfully. In fact, the Desert Fathers and Mothers, on whose teaching our meditation is based, as discovered by John Maine, stressed the inevitability of thought. Let me just read that little story for you. A brother came to our pastor and said, "Many distraction thoughts come into my mind, and I'm in danger because of them." Then the elder thrust him out in the open air and said, "Open up your garments about your chest and catch the wind in them." But the young one replied, "This I cannot do." So the elder said to him, "If you cannot catch the wind, neither can you prevent distracting thoughts from coming into your head." We have to accept our thoughts as a natural part of ourselves. And as we do that, they get quieter. Our thoughts and images and feelings are only a problem if we get hooked by them, if we get tempted to follow their lead. But here, we have a choice. We have a free choice. We can either tag along with our thoughts or focus on our mantra. It's a totally free choice. Sometimes naming your thoughts, just thoughts, or just smile at them. I find smiling helps. It helps us to stay detached from them. And slowly they quieten and get less demanding. In fact, they are like that so-called music. I used to call it muzak in the supermarket. You hear it, but you're not really aware of it. Are you? So that is what you can do with your thoughts. And when we switch our attention all the way gently back to our word, we become aware of the gaps between the thoughts. And eventually, these gaps get wider and the mantra reigns supreme in the gaps. They are the doors to silence. In fact, the true nature of our mind is not thoughts, but silence. Meister Eckhart said, "Nothing describes God as well as silence." In our essence, we are children of God. So we are children of eternal.
Oh, no.
Well, he hasn't given up. He definitely hasn't given up. If we manage to hold on to the mantra, the ego may whisper to us, "Isn't this boring? Just repeating a word. What a con. Variety is the spice of life."
Kim, yeah. It froze for a few moments. I don't know whether it was recording, but it froze when you said, essentially, we are children of God.
Right.
Could you...
I'll start again there. That's a good point anyway to repeat.
Start in that sentence, yeah.
Yeah. So Meister Eckhart said, "Nothing describes God as well as silence." Therefore, in our essence, we are children of God, children of eternal silence. And our thoughts appear against this matrix of silence. So whatever the ego says, we need to persevere. If we manage to hold on to the mantra, the ego may whisper, "Isn't this boring? Just repeating a word. What a con. Variety is the spice of life." Are you still meditating? Then it says, "Don't just sit there, do something." It wants us to go off and forget this journey in activity, amusement, and work. Well, meditation is the revolutionary discipline that asks us to do the opposite. Don't just do something, sit there. We are encouraged to sit still in silence, faithful to one thing only, to say our word lovingly. You think you have silenced the ego? Oh, no way, no way. It now tries a different approach, playing on our need for diversity, and says, "Are you sure this is the right method or the right mantra? Shouldn't you change your mantra? This one isn't working." And by encouraging us to chop and change again, the ego is making sure we're not going anywhere. Lawrence, I'm sure you remember that story from the desert where the farmer was trying to dig a well, and he dug a hole in the field, and he went down, no water. So he came out, tried to dug another hole, went a little deeper, still no water. And at the end of the day, he had a field full of holes and no water. Whereas if he had stayed in one spot, he would have hit the water he wished for. And that is like our mantra in a way. Well, stay with it and stay aware of these tricks, because even the peace and silence we may reach can become a way in for the ego to tempt us and encouraging us to let go of the mantra. We may even convince ourselves that the mantra disturbs our peace. That's quite an important one, isn't it? Finally, he's getting quite fed up with us still sitting there. So he now says, well, I don't know, but this is, to me, this is very self-indulgent. You should do something useful for others instead. Now, this has often been an accusation thrown at contemplatives. But as we are healed and integrated because of contacting the silence in our being, which is us, which is the Christ within that dwells in our center, we start to act from that deeper center. And then if we do something, it will be truly useful to others, because it's done out of love. There is a lovely story. I can't remember. I think it's from the Buddhist tradition. I'm sorry, I love my stories. I hope you do too. A certain Chinese village had been for some weeks without rain when they sent for a rainmaker. On the old man's arrival, he went straight to the house provided for him, and there he stayed without performing any ceremonies until the rains came. On being asked how he caused the rain to fall, the old man explained that causation had nothing to do with it. Upon arriving in the village, the rainmaker had realized that there was a state of disharmony, and consequently, the normal processes of nature were not operating according to their proper design. The rainmaker himself was also affected. So the old man retired to his hut to compose himself. When his internal harmony was restored and equilibrium established, then the rain fell, as is its natural pattern to do. So only when we are harmonious will our action be helpful. Well, despite all these thoughts of the ego, congratulations, you have persevered. And you will have moments of silence, stillness, and joy. Sometimes you experience something more than just a glimpse. And it is as if the spiritual energy, the divine around us, wants to encourage us. And whenever we feel discouraged and want to listen to the ego, All we need to do is remember that moment of grace. So there we are, nicely in the silence. And then what happens? We discover why the ego did not want us to go there, because we have accessed a lower level of consciousness where the ego has deposited any experience that threatened our survival. Here are all the suppressed feelings, some of them perhaps traumatic, but let's see what happens. Suddenly, tears stream down your face. I've had that in groups, and people come afterwards and say, very embarrassed, "I'm so sorry, I don't know what it is." And I said, "No, that is wonderful. These are the tears you should have shed at the time when perhaps it wasn't appropriate and you suppressed them." Another feeling, common feeling, is irritation. And I tell my husband Shankar that you better keep your head under the parapet because I'm irritable. But of course, the secret is to note those feelings, accept them, but not act on them. Not act on them at all. There may even be anger. It's amazing how much anger we suppress because it's not appropriate. If your boss is being unfair to you, you can hardly start shouting at him angrily, can you? So you suppress it. Then comes boredom caused by suppressing, dryness, pointlessness. Up pops the ego. What is the point in doing this if you feel worse afterwards? Let the past be. But Eileen O'Hay, Lawrence, you remember her with as much affection as I do. In our community, once gave a wonderful retreat with you and her. And she said about these emotions that surface, she called them frozen blocks of ice. And she said, encourage them to come up and hold them up in the love and light of the divine, and they will melt. And along with that, they will release all the energy needed to suppress them. You don't realize how much energy we waste suppressing our emotions. But I love this image of our frozen blocks of ice melting in the love and light of God. Well, that was a little hint of the shadow, all these emotions coming up. But next time, I will introduce you properly to him. And I will teach you to befriend your shadow, acknowledge and help understand him, and perhaps even dance with him. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Kim, for speaking. It was a wonderful way of understanding some of the resistance that we feel, some of the complications or some of the discouragement that we can find ourselves in on the path, and just identifying it and naming it in the clear, gentle way that you've done, I think is good food for the journey and something we can draw on when those moments come. And we look forward to next time. Thank you so much, Kim.
Thank you.
You've been listening to A Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. To learn more about our guest or anything else mentioned in this episode, please check out the links in the show notes or visit us online at wccm.org. Goodbye.